Blog Talk Radio.
That I know how to handle these crises.
We are and always will be the United States of America.
Excuse me, Fox News.
A series of tubes.
I think we look pretty good.
I'll get Osama bin Laden, my friends. I'll get him. I know how to get him.
E pluribus unum. Out of many, one.
If some of those jobs are lost in this, so be it.
Thank you, Wisconsin!
Liberals and conservatives, Democrats and Republicans, moderates of all opinions, welcome to Civil Discourse. My name is Eric Brandt. With me, as always, is former State Senator Peter Baer. How's it going, Peter?
Going well, Eric. How are you doing?
I am doing great. Hope that all of our listeners are doing well. You can hear us every Saturday here live at 11 o'clock a.m. Central Standard Time. Just go to blogtalkradio.com, do a search for Janesville Community Radio, and click on their link, and then you'll see a link for Civil Discourse. Just click on that, and we will be live to your computer. And you can also listen to the archived episodes if you miss it when we're live. Right at Blog Talk Radio, same link, or you can go to civildiscourse.podomatic.com and you'll see many more of our archived files there. Well, Peter, it's been a very interesting week here.
It has, and I should note, by the way, Eric, if you don't mind my just interjecting this to the point, we're having a break this week between having had some very distinguished guests in the recent past, including Senators Colin and Erpenbach and Representative Hasselbein, but also, and I'm sure you're planning to mention it later, but we're expecting to have Mary Burke, the probable nominee for governor of the Democratic Party in Wisconsin,
as
our guest
right.
next week. So this week, it's just up to us to engage our listeners, and hopefully we will live up to their expectations.
This is going to be kind of a retro show. This one is going to be kind of dig into the hearts of our loyal listeners who've been with us for the past couple of years as we've been doing this. A lot of you probably remember that before we joined up with Janesville Community Radio, Peter and I had guests on occasionally, but most of the time we had a little bit different format. It was just Peter and I, and we would kind of dig into a subject and do a historical perspective on it. And we're going to do that again today, and I'm really looking forward to it. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. As everybody knows, it's already May, and Congress has basically done nothing this year. I don't even know what they're on track for this year, but last year was the least ever.
They have done one thing that doesn't get mentioned that much, but they have collected paychecks on a monthly basis, which I presume every member has actually converted into liquid funds.
You know, it's really funny that you bring that up because we didn't even talk about this. And the next thing, literally the next thing on my list here was after Do Nothing Congress, state government adjourned for year. They're now campaigning, but still taking a paycheck. That's what I had written down. You took the words out of my mouth. Great minds think alike. Walker is on the campaign trail. And not much is happening at the state level. Obama is doing what he can at the executive level, which is really ticking off Republicans. But over the last couple weeks, the action has really been at the judicial level. The Supreme Court has made some decisions. Federal courts are making some decisions. And I don't think that a lot of people truly understand how powerful the courts are in our country. I think, you know, the political junkies who are listening to us right now, you guys, I'm sure, have a good understanding of what the courts can do. But I think most people kind of think of when you get a speeding ticket, you go see a judge. You know, judges handle traffic violations, lawsuits. If there's a murder in your area, a judge is going to be involved with that. And I think that is backed up by the historically seeing such low turnout for judicial elections.
Absolutely right. Eric, I'd like to reinforce what you've said here by saying, first of all, I totally agree with every word you just said. And it's proved by the, as you say, the low turnouts typically in judicial elections. And for reasons, historical reasons that I'm not entirely knowledgeable about, it tends to be that judicial elections are not held at the same time as elections for members of Congress and president, which would bring about a larger turnout, at least.
I think there's a political reason behind that.
Yeah, I suspect that's the case because the people who set it up maybe don't want everybody voting. for a judge. They don't. As a matter of fact, we have a few politicians in the state, like our governor, for example, who don't want too many people voting in any election, as far as that goes. But with specific focus on the judiciary, here's the other thing that tells me that you're correct in everything you just said. It's not only the fact that we get low turnouts in judicial elections, to wit, and if you don't believe me, just ask Judge Fallone, or Judge Kloppenberg. But it's not just that. It's that in presidential elections, in my experience, which goes back a pretty long ways, I can't recall any presidential election, which in my vivid recollections of presidential elections go back through Johnson and even to some extent through Kennedy. I was young then, so I wasn't absorbing as much, but I was absorbing virtually every issue by the time of the Johnson-Goldwater election. So that goes back to 64 up until now. That's a long time. It's never been a major issue in a presidential campaign that the president gets to nominate the Supreme Court justices. And yet, it is one of, if not the most significant power. I suppose the power to conduct war would be maybe one step higher, but it is certainly one of the top two or three powers of the president of the United States of America.
Without a doubt.
And yet you never hear of it as a major issue. You may hear it mentioned here and there a little bit now and then, but compared to, for example, issues related to the NRA or issues related to tax breaks for the rich or issues of war and peace, which are valid issues, of course, you just don't hear much conversation about the Supreme Court justices.
And Joe Biden was the only one in 2012 that I remember talking about it.
And Joe Biden is such a bright guy. For some reason, he just doesn't seem to have the whatever the charisma is necessary to actually win a presidential election. But that he sure is a smart, knowledgeable guy. And he did focus on that, but nobody cared. I don't think Joe Biden ever got more than 4% or 3%.
No, I'm talking in 2012 when he was debating Paul Ryan. He brought it up. Yeah.
But even then, nobody cared, unfortunately. But where it really troubles me is when we get certain times and one of the one that sticks the most in my mind is the election of Hubert Humphrey versus Richard Nixon, when many of our, let's say, Democratic brethren on the left.
It would have been Bobby. Would have been Bobby.
Right. But the fact of the matter is, and it wasn't Humphrey's fault, that Bobby wasn't alive to be the nominee at that time. People might have wanted to blame it on Humphrey somehow, but it wasn't Humphrey who did that. Humphrey's biggest problem, of course, was being vice president for Johnson at the time, who now with the historical perspective we enjoy all these years later, we can see that in many respects, Lyndon Johnson was one of the greatest presidents we've ever had in terms of civil rights. But the Vietnam War is a bloody stain that will never be erased. So at that time, people didn't have the historical perspective to see the brilliance of Johnson in civil rights. They were much more concerned about the war in Vietnam still being waged, and Humphrey never was an avid supporter of the war, but he never came out and really opposed the president, and he kind of quietly backed the president. So he took a lot of blame for that from Bobby supporters, from Gene McCarthy supporters, and they said they didn't vote for Nixon, but what they did was they just said, to heck with it, we're not going to vote.
That's exactly what happened.
And guess who got to nominate 5 Supreme Court justices? Richard Nixon. If there was no other reason, even if they disliked Humphrey for every other reason, which wouldn't be justified because he was also a great fighter for civil rights, but if they just were pissed at Humphrey because of... am I allowed to say that on the air?
Well, it's on the internet. There's nothing we can do about it.
There it goes. Okay. Some people were disturbed about Humphrey on the war. Okay, understandable. But, you know, his civil rights record, he stood for hours and hours and hours alone on the Senate floor through the middle of the night, keeping civil rights bills alive. He was a hero when it came to civil rights in this country, perhaps only to be exceeded by Lyndon Johnson, or maybe even not exceeded by Lyndon Johnson or John Kennedy. Humphrey was great, but people were ticked about the war. They voted. They didn't bother to show up. Nixon won a very close election, very, very close, and appointed 5 justices to the Supreme Court, which molded America for generations. because they're lifetime appointments.
Exactly.
And if and I think if the more left-wing element of the Democratic Party back in 68 had been focused, had been, if someone could have said to them, Richard Nixon is going to get 5 appointments to the Supreme Court, isn't that enough to get you out to the polls? If it had been put in those terms, I think the turnout could have increased a little bit in a few states, and Humphrey would have been president, and it would have changed history.
I would agree with you. If I thought that people understood what that meant, I still don't think that people understand how important those 5 justices are. And that's the thing is, yes, there's 9 on the bench, but it only takes 5 to change almost anything in this country. And that's what makes them so powerful. As Peter and I were discussing right now, the way that our country is set up, you know, Congress under the Constitution can actually regulate the Supreme Court, which seems to be a part of the Constitution. They just forgot about, but that's a different conversation. But Congress can pass different laws. The president can sign them. The president can pass executive orders. The states and the governors can do whatever they want, it, within reason. However, no matter what they do, the Supreme Court is kind of like, you know, the parents just sitting there watching them play. But as soon as the Supreme Court sees something they don't like, they can stop it. Or they can enact it. And that's the thing. I mean, look at you look at Dred Scott, Brown v. Board of Education. You've got Citizens United. They put George Bush in the White House, okay? I mean, all of these things.
That was a very serious matter, since the Florida Supreme Court had just voted 8-0. A bipartisan Supreme Court in Florida voted by 8-0 for a full recount of the state of Florida, which was within a tenth of a percent, not even a tenth of a percent, less than that, was the difference between Bush and Gore in Florida. So a recount, at worst, it's a flip of the coin that that Gore, who won the popular vote, could also have won the electoral vote and been president, and there would have been no war in Iraq,
exactly.
For example, and the whole Bush economic cataclysm that took President Obama, in spite of fierce Republican hostility and opposition, that has taken him these 5 years to pretty much right the ship, at least, that we're back, at least now we're not circling the drain anymore, that was a decision of 5 people who just said, too bad about the Florida Supreme Court, too bad about the citizens of Florida who voted, too bad about the citizens of the United States. Justice Sandra Day O'Connor was quoted in a prominent and reputable publication as having said to some people at a cocktail party during that short pendency of the Bush v. Gore case, we aren't going to let this happen. Namely, we aren't going to let Gore be president. The arrogance is, I mean, in my view, I know I'm stating something that sounds rather extreme to some people, but I'm going to say it anyway because I believe it. It was a really big, I don't know if there's any precedent in the history of the United States for what was essentially a bloodless in the sense of it didn't happen by revolution within the country. Bloodless coup d'etat is what the Supreme Court essentially committed at that. They even went so far as to do something that you and I talked about before the show. They knew their decision was so, to put it kindly, so lightweight, so ephemeral, so on thin legal ice, that they prefaced their decision in Bush v. Gore by saying, everything we say in our opinion here that is about to install George W. Bush, who lost the election as president, doesn't count for any other case that ever happens in the future. It only applies to this case here where we're going to make Bush president. Can you imagine that? And yet, that is what happened. That is literally the history of the situation.
And You know, we're talking about all of these things, and I want to get into a historical perspective here, and I'm going to kind of jump into how judges got this power. While I'm doing that, Peter, I'm actually going to ask, can you change chairs? That one's squeaking, and it's probably showing up on the mic. So how did the judicial branch get this kind of power? Well, The election of 1800 saw a revolution in our country. President John Adams lost his presidency to Thomas Jefferson, and Jefferson's party took control over both parties of Congress. In response to this revolution, Adams and the Federalists started to lay anchors in the judicial system in an effort to hold on to as much control as possible for as long as possible. And they did this through the judicial system. They passed the Judiciary Act of 1801 in February of 1801. Now, remember, this is back before presidents were inaugurated in January. Back then, it was March 4th, I believe. So the Federalists had contemplated judicial reform for years. And after Jefferson's revolution, they decided to act. Governor Morris offered justification, saying, "The leaders of the Federal Party are about to experience a heavy gale of adverse wind. Can they be blamed for casting many anchors to hold their ship through the storm?" Does that sound familiar? Maybe voter suppression and gerrymandering that we're seeing today. They knew they were on their way out, so they did everything they could to hold power however they could. So what was the Judiciary Act of 1801? Well, it reduced the size of the Supreme Court. At that time it had six justices. Adams reduced that to five. Why would he do that? Well, he didn't remove anyone from the bench. All he did is he left all six, but said that as soon as one of them leaves, we're not going to replace them. What that did is it made Thomas Jefferson wait for two justices to leave the bench under whatever circumstances before he could appoint one. That was a way that they're rigging the system, is they didn't want him putting two liberals on there, so they just got rid of one. We're seeing those kinds of things right now. We saw it on the D.C. Circuit Court when the Republicans in the Senate refused to seat the three empty seats that Obama was trying to fill.
In my view, the action of Senate Republicans in Washington in not confirming judicial nominees of President Obama, I'm not even referring to the few cases where they may actually have some strong political disagreements, which still shouldn't prevent the confirmation, but at least could legitimately lead to a debate. No. On general principles, all of his nominees have been roadblocked, have been filibustered, just because he nominated them. Even people who were, who are distinguished jurists that nobody complains about any aspect of their character or their judicial careers. And they do it only because Obama nominated him.
Exactly.
So fortunately, Harry Reid, working no doubt hand in glove with the president, made the decision, okay, enough of this. We can't have an empty benches. The cases aren't moving. Our system of justice is, if not grinding to a halt, at least slowing down to an unacceptably slow pace. One of the things that we have in our Constitution is the right to speedy trials. Justice delayed is justice denied. That's not a constitutional term, but that is a commonly accepted political dictum in the United States of America. Justice delayed is justice denied. Can anybody with any common sense question that, the truth of that fact? So the Republicans don't care about justice denied, obviously, because they delay justice by not confirming judges. So now that's been taken care of by letting the majority party vote in the majority to confirm justices. So we now, at least some of the justices are coming onto the bench and the courts can be doing their jobs.
Right. And we're going to touch on to all of that later. But what that really boils down to is this history that we're talking about right now, the Republicans get it. And they've gotten it for a very long time. And that's the game that they've been playing. The Judiciary Act, also a couple weeks, actually, sorry, I missed my spot here. A couple weeks later, another act was passed that created the D.C. Circuit Court. And they also, in the Judiciary Act, here I am, I found my spot, created six new circuit courts, which presided over 16 new circuit court judges, or they were presided by 16 new circuit court judges. Well, Adams was still in office, and he still had the Senate until everything flipped over in a couple weeks. So who do you think got to appoint them? They were all staunch conservatives. A lot of people don't maybe realize or remember that John Adams was our first very conservative president, and Jefferson was our first very liberal president. George Washington, I guess, was somewhere in between. But when Adams was leaving, he was not leaving in a very happy way. Let's put it that way. And he was trying to really game the system. So the outgoing Congress appointed new judges and personnel at lightning speed, but they were not able to seat the newly appointed Justice of the Peace, William Marbury. Jefferson and his Secretary of State, James Madison, refused to seat Marbury as Justice of the Peace on the D.C. Circuit Court. Marbury took him to court, where the infamous Marbury versus Madison case was decided. The court ruled that Jefferson and Madison were wrong to refuse Mr. Marbury his appointment, but they also ruled that the Supreme Court didn't have jurisdiction over the case. Using an arguably flawed interpretation of the Judiciary Act of 1789, Chief Justice Marshall claimed that the law gave the court broad in jurisdiction, although a truer interpretation would be that it only allowed the Supreme Court to issue writs of mandamus in cases where the court already had jurisdiction. But by using the flawed interpretation, Marshall, who simply did not want to rule in favor of Jefferson and Madison, this was a political decision, by using the flawed interpretation, he decided to rule the Judiciary Act of 1789 was unconstitutional because Article 3 of the Constitution denies Congress the right to expand the court's jurisdiction. This, in turn, denied the court jurisdiction over Marbury, deciding not only that Jefferson didn't have to seat Marbury, but that the court can knock down federal laws. Now, Jefferson knew that this was bad, and he called it a fellow to say. He said that it was if this ruling was allowed to stand, the Constitution would become a thing of wax in the hands of the court, molding it to however they saw fit. And he was absolutely right. We have seen that ever since. Now, this is all now one common misconception about the Marbury rule, which is believed to establish judicial review, which is what they did right here, judicial review, where they said that the Judiciary Act of 1789 was unconstitutional. That's judiciary review. They're telling Congress and the president, no, what you did is unconstitutional. We're saying you can't do that. It's null and void. A lot of people attribute Marbury as the precedent for that. But the fact of the matter is that Marbury was maybe the first time that they made a ruling like that, but they didn't actually create that rule in Marbury, because the Constitution doesn't give the Supreme Court the right to knock these laws down, but it doesn't take it away either. And so there was this, for, you know, 50 years ahead of time, there was this debate going on in the federal government and in the colonies and everything about should judges be able to do this? And there were some people who said yes, there were some people no, but there was a large majority who said maybe, but that really needs to be reined in. This was the first time where they actually used it. And now this has evolved into something where the Supreme Court is basically, they rule on little else. At least what hits the news is things where they're knocking down federal laws. Look at when Obamacare went in to the Supreme Court, that was national news because they were deciding, did Congress do something we like or not? Citizens United, they knocked down McCain-Feingold. Right. The McCutcheon decision, they're knocking down all these rules. The Civil Rights Amendment, again.
That was terrible. The most shocking and striking to me of all of the ones you've mentioned are unbelievable. These
Roe v. Wade,
Citizens United, is a horrific decision. But the one that really got me even more than that, on principle, although Citizens United might be more important in terms of the ultimate impact on the political process, but the one that was really striking to me because it was the most clear example of judicial activism that I can think of, certainly at high judicial level, such as the Supreme Court, was when the Supreme Court recently ruled that the Voting Rights Act, which had been as recently as under President George W. Bush, overwhelmingly approved by both houses of Congress.
Peter, I want you to hold that thought for 1 second. We missed our cue. We have to hit a break.
Okay.
But we'll talk a bit more about the Voting Rights Act ruling in just a second. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
check out the new business center that has opened in downtown Janesville. My office, JVL, provides full business services for home-based companies or the professional that only needs an occasional meeting space in the Rock County area. Professional, fully staffed, and convenient, my office, JVL, can provide you with everything from a virtual office address to an on-site copy center, office space, and a full-sized conference room. www.myoffice-jvl.com.
And we are back. You are listening to Civil Discourse on Janesville Community Radio. My name is Eric Brandt. With me is former State Senator Peter Baer. You can hear us every week at 11 o'clock. We will be live. You can listen to us online at blogtalkradio.com. Do a search for Janesville Community Radio. Click on their link and then click on the link for Civil Discourse. And if you would like to call in, we'd love to hear your thoughts. We're talking about judicial review, and you can give us a call at 323-580-5769. Let us know how you feel about the fact that the courts are essentially running our country at this point. Peter, right before we went to break, you were starting to talk about the Supreme Court's ruling on the Voting Rights Act.
Right. The shocking thing to me about that in particular, the most shocking thing, was that it was so recent that the Congress of the United States – and, of course, anyone who has even a rudimentary high school civics understanding of the government of the United States knows that we have three branches of government. We have the legislative, the executive, and the judiciary. The legislature makes the laws. The executive administers the laws, may make suggestions to the legislature about laws that they can pass, but doesn't have the authority to pass them, has the authority only to sign or veto them, and then, if signing them, execute them. And the judiciary then has the duty, when the cases arise, to review matters that, where the issue is whether or not a ruling from a court below is constitutional or not. Okay? Now, as a historical matter, just in the way that Republicans have traditionally tried to position themselves as the party of fiscal responsibility and the Democrats as wild spenders, even though that is not at all the truth overall, even though they have tried to portray themselves as more militarily strong and muscular in terms of the United States versus perceived or actual enemies around the world, even though President Obama's presidency has shown quite the contrary, as did President Clinton's, as far as I'm concerned. One of the other great lies, fallacies, or to use the Joseph Goebbels, that was the propaganda minister of Germany back in the late 30s and early 40s, the big lie, you just keep saying a lie long enough and people start believing it. And the other one that Republicans are particularly known for is saying that Democrats or people appointed by Democrats on the court lean towards judicial activism, where Republicans, on the contrary, just stick to the Constitution. Well, this Republican court, 5-4 Republican, ruled that a law that was reaffirmed, I guess we could say, because it was an existing law already, but it was voted, it continued, extended by the Congress under George W. Bush by overwhelming majorities. Almost, I think one house was unanimous, wasn't it? I think the Senate was unanimous.
But it was pretty close.
Close to unanimous. Not close in votes. These were overwhelming lopsided votes where there was no controversy to extending this legislation. Okay? So here we are, only what, 5-6 years later? The Supreme Court says, well, that's old news. Whatever was true, whatever the Congress of the United States, the elected representatives of the people in the House and in the Senate, decided in their overwhelming, rarely, but in this case, bipartisan support, the Supreme Court says, well, yeah, but that was 5-6 years ago. It doesn't really count anymore. If that's not judicial activism, there is no such thing as judicial activism. It is the most extreme case of judicial activism I can think of, and it was done by Republicans.
Well, I don't even remember if it's what Ruth Bader Ginsburg said on the bench or if she just said something close, but it's like putting your umbrella away while it's raining because you're not getting wet. Well, as soon as you get rid of the umbrella, you're going to get wet again.
Exactly. But I would like to make one other point, though, because we've been talking so far, Eric, about the negative impact of courts having so much power. And a lot of it is negative, and that's why people need to understand it better and take more time to look at candidates, vote in judicial elections, and consider when voting for president, among the whatever other issues they want to think about, I think a voter is derelict in his or her duty as a voter to not think about Supreme Court as at least part of their consideration of who they vote for president. But having said that, there's also the positive side of it, which and we have news from this last week to this effect.
We do, and just one more note before we get into that, because this kind of leads into why this first part is so important, is that at this point, the Obama administration had lost about 5 years of nominating judges. And last year in 2013, Harry Reid changed the rules, so any judges below Supreme Court only need a simple majority. The Supreme Court still can be filibustered. But a simple majority can pass a judge at any lower level.
Imagine what a radical concept. A simple majority can prevail.
Who knew?
Yeah.
But with the possibility that the Republicans could take the Senate in November's election, the Obama administration is working overtime to appoint and confirm the laundry list of new judges on their list. For 5 years, the GOP has been blocking votes in the Senate. And now that they only need a 51-vote majority, they're putting through as many people as they can. And it's, you know, part of the reason for this, just to set up what you're about to go into, Peter, is that the inherent power of the U.S. courts has caused both parties to pine for young, enthusiastic nominees that can hold a seat literally for decades. And, I mean, Scalia's been on since what? Was he a Reagan appointee? He's been on,
I believe so,
forever, yeah. You know? And yeah. Justice Stevens, John Paul Stevens, when he left in 2009, 10, something like that, he was on for, you know, decades.
Yes.
And the president's Reagan.
Rehnquist, who was, of course, no longer with us, but was appointed by Nixon, was on for decades.
Well, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, yeah. You know. I mean, right. There's a really good article about this.
At least she's a good one, though.
Exactly. There's something I want to bring up about her later, too. But the New York Times did a good article about this. And, you know, they said the presidents Reagan and Bush left a lasting mark on the federal courts by appointing young conservative judges who could sit on the bench and affect policy for decades. Obama is seeking to do the same with liberals. There are currently 86 vacancies in the federal courts. Obama has sent 49 nominees to the Senate to fill those slots. 19 are pending in the Judiciary Committee and 30 are awaiting votes by the full Senate. If you remember, and Peter, you might remember this graph more than I do, when Harry Reid blew up the filibuster, Rachel Maddow had done a show and she showed a graph. And at that point, I think that the federal judges were evenly split between Democrats and Republicans, and I don't remember what the numbers were. I'm going to be wrong here, but I could be way, way off, but if my memory serves, it was like 360 of each or something like that.
It's very close. Very close.
And Obama had 90 to appoint, which was going to swing it in the liberal direction.
Yes.
And that's why the Republicans were freaking out so bad.
A perfect segue to the issue of the day, if I may say, and I'm proud, and I don't want to personalize this overly, but I just can't help but say that I had the privilege of sitting next to Lynn Edelman when he was chairman of the State Senate Judiciary Committee, and I served as his vice chair, and I'm so proud to even know him. I always have been, but particularly after what he did as a federal judge this week, when he struck down the Walker's and the Republican legislature's lockstep voting rights law in Wisconsin, which was clearly and blatantly and despicably unconstitutional, and for the only possible reason for that law was to prevent citizens from voting who were likely to vote Democrat, so that it would improve the chances of Governor Walker to be reelected, so he can stay in continue to downgrade our state at every level and also run for president, God, if one can imagine. And so that's the purpose. The purpose of the law was to simply cut out as many people as possible who would be lower income, older, or otherwise less likely to be able to have the wherewithal to go obtain these cards that would now be necessary to vote. Judge Adelman wrote a very lengthy and very detailed opinion that was going to stand up well, I think, and I hope, if it has to face appellate scrutiny. It's clear to me, not only from my knowing him personally from years ago as serving on the Judiciary Committee together, but also so I knew him as a politician before he was a judge, and I know something about how he thinks, and he's a very, very, very diligent and explicit thinker when it comes to issues of constitutionality. And he wrote his opinion in such a way that he addressed all of the potential issues that are going to come up on appeal, if in fact it goes to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. We don't know for sure that it even will, but it might.
And Van Hollen has said he's going to appeal, yeah, so Van my Hollen, guess is that it will.
By the way, Van Hollen looked pretty vacuous to me as he was trying to explain why he was doing this. Just, you know, when a person of reasonable intelligence, which I assume Van Hollen has, sits there trying to mouth a party line that has absolutely no intrinsic merit. It's a painful thing to watch and listen to. But anyway, I got to watch and listen to that yesterday. But so he says he's going to go do that. But this Judge Adelman has written his opinion in such a way that he has addressed all the constitutional issues with great specificity. And he points out that at trial, there was no evidence presented by the state of any present voter fraud. So in other words, this was a solution looking for a problem. And it's not even a solution looking for a problem. That gives it too much dignity and too much credit. That would suggest that maybe Republicans are merely misguided, thinking that there's a voter fraud problem and not waiting until they really have the evidence and just jumping ahead of themselves and passing the law. That's not what it's about. They don't think there's a problem. They know perfectly well that there's no voting fraud problem in Wisconsin. There hasn't been in memory. And nothing that would rise to the level of even being something the legislature needs to address. Judge Adelman specifically said in his opinion that there is not any doubt whatsoever that if this law was allowed to go into effect, it would prevent more legitimately qualified voters from voting than it could ever prevent unqualified voters from voting.
Peter, can you hopefully remember, what's the name of the Wisconsin State Senator from the Waukesha area? She's a woman. She faced a recall, and she won in 2012.
Alberta Darling.
That's it, Alberta Darling. She was subject, I believe, to a FOIA, Freedom of Information Act. I don't remember who filed it, but they were looking for her records of proof that there was voting fraud going on in Wisconsin, and she wasn't able to provide anything. That was a couple years ago.
And Judge Adelman spent plenty of time in his lengthy opinion, which will have to be reviewed if Van Hollen is true to his word and takes it to the Seventh Circuit. The Seventh Circuit is obliged to read very carefully every word written by Adelman in determining whether his decision should be upheld or reversed. And in his decision, he points out that they provided no evidence of voter fraud. And yet they're putting a burden on at least, I think the number was about 30,000 people were expected to be effectively, you can't say for sure how many, it could be more, could be a little less. I think probably more likely to be more, but in any case, the estimate was about 30,000 qualified electors, citizens qualified to cast a vote, who because of some either physical infirmity, a condition of indigency limiting travel, or other such factors, would be denied the vote. Now, if we would happen to have a very close election in November between Governor Walker and Mary Burke, which is not a long shot that it's going to be a close election. I mean, maybe, who knows, maybe Mary Burke will win by a big amount. Maybe Walker will. But the odds are, I think if you ask most of the smart folks these days and the ones who conduct the polls, it's looking pretty close. It's going to be a close election. 30,000 votes could make that difference. That bill could be the difference between the voters getting to decide who the governor will be or not.
I completely agree. And MSNBC has an article about this, and they said Judge Adelman set a new precedent in his ruling, citing Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act is new grounds in these challenges and could be used in Texas and North Carolina, where the U.S. Justice Department is challenging similar laws. Adelman writes, "Virtually no voter impersonation occurs in Wisconsin, and it is exceedingly unlikely that voter impersonation will become a problem in Wisconsin in the foreseeable future." Rejecting the state's claim that the law is needed to promote public confidence in elections, which is kind of a straw man that they're putting out there.
Demagoguery at its most clear, in its clearest form.
Adelman said, "Perhaps the reason why photo ID requirements have no effect on confidence or trust in the electoral process is that such laws undermine the public's confidence in the electoral process as much as they promote it."
You've just given me an idea, Eric, just by citing all that stuff that I hadn't even thought about before. This whole process of voter ID cards, you know how there are people who get into the business of making fake IDs for people so that people under 21 can go get alcohol at bars and stuff like that. And, you know, in fact, that's probably the most common abuse of that sort of thing. But think about it. We've now got a system which is, by all accounts, one of the cleanest voting systems in the country. Okay? By all studies, all statistical studies have shown that Wisconsin elections are among the cleanest, if one of we've been rated one of the top two states consistently in that regard. So this is a situation where you have a new card being issued, which could theoretically create a possibility of voter fraud that didn't exist before, because you could be issuing cards that are fake cards, or somebody could get into a system in a way that you could actually be creating the opportunity for voter fraud, which doesn't exist today. I haven't heard that argument articulated before, but it seems to me to be a real possibility.
I have some comments on that. Stay with us through the break. We have we're going to our final break, and then we'll be back for about the last 15 minutes of the show here. And stay with us. We'll be right back.
Have you heard about the chocolate available that tastes good and provides natural energy through B12 supplements? Are you looking for a motivation to lose weight or improve your health? Contact Chocolates for Life for free samples of a new cutting-edge supplement that tastes good and is good for you. More information is available at www.chocolates4life.com.
And we are back. My name's Eric Brandt. You're listening to Civil Discourse. With me is former Democratic State Senator Peter Baer. We are live every Saturday at 11 on Janesville Community Radio. Just go to blogtalkradio.com, do a search for Janesville Community Radio, click on their page, and then click on the Civil Discourse link. If you are listening live, we would love to hear what you have to say about our conversation today concerning judicial review, voter ID, the Supreme Court's power. 323-580-5769. Give us a call. We'd love to hear your thoughts.
By the way, Erica, no one's ever asked us to comment on any of our sponsors' advertisements, and so maybe I shouldn't even do it, but it's very positive, so hopefully no one will object. If it is really possible to have a chocolate that you can eat and lose weight by eating chocolate, I personally am interested, and I hope that our listeners will also take an interest in such an opportunity.
We'll head down to my office, JVL, in Janesville, and they just might be able to point you in the right direction there. Peter, right before we went to the break, you brought up an interesting point that is something I wanted to talk about. And you said, well, you know, these voter IDs, if they're going to issue a new card that's going to have a photo ID, it could actually open up the possibility for people to produce fraudulent cards. My thoughts on this is, first off, back in the 90s, Bill Clinton proposed a national ID. It's something that he wanted to do, and the Republicans started screaming 1984, Big Brother, we can't do this, you know, big government liberals, blah, blah, blah. So it didn't happen. Now they're going through and they're trying to force us to show IDs to vote, but every state's doing it different. In Wisconsin, it's one thing. Down in Texas, your student ID is not going to work, but your concealed carry permit does. Okay? So tell me that that's not aimed at right-wing people to have an easier time than Democrats.
I'm not going to tell you that. That would be a lie.
It would be. Now, here's the thing. Is they're making it really difficult. They're not issuing an actual card. That's the thing, is they want you to have a voter ID, but there is no voter ID card that you can go purchase. You can use a driver's license.
No, you can go join the NRA.
You can join the NRA.
Then you have a valid card. See?
In Texas, but not here, not in Florida. I mean, that's the thing. It's different everywhere that you go.
Yes, it is. And that's a very important point. The cultural differences between places. It so happens that at one time, between my present legal career and a previous business career, I got involved in an opportunity that never came to fruition for me, but it was the nation of India, which is the largest democracy in the world in terms of the number of people who actually vote in what are considered to be essentially free and fair elections, by far the largest, because China doesn't have those type of elections, and the only country other than China that with more people than the United States is India, and India has at least 3.5 times more people than the United States. So it's the largest democracy in the world. But in India, there's a much more serious history of corruption in voting, ballot stuffing, stuff of that nature than we have in the United States, and particularly in Wisconsin, which does not have the problem, has not had the problem. The country of India was deciding that they were going to, and they have gone ahead and done it. They just didn't do it through mechanism that I was hoping to be involved in, but so be it. But they do have voter ID cards in India now. But that's India, and when you consider that it's a country that has a history of certain of the states of India, like Uttar Pradesh or whatever the state might be, Punjab, where there has been a history of some pretty fairly significant, let's say, messing around at the ballot box. In a situation like India, it could be quite a valid exercise of government. In fact, it's an exercise of very prudent government responsibility in India to issue those voter cards, in my opinion. But that's India. That's not the United States. The United States has a very different political history than India. For one thing, India has only been an independent country since 1948. Or 47 or 48, one or the other. And so they have a lot less history than we do, and there's a lot more history of corruption, let's just face it. So having the voter ID cards is actually a step towards a stronger democracy in India. But here in the United States, and particularly here in Wisconsin, in this part of the country, we don't have any of that kind of history.
That's exactly right. We don't. And, you know, I'm going to throw something out there from a completely different angle. And I've actually said this on this show before, probably back when this whole thing started. It was a long time ago. I've talked about it with friends, and I'm pretty certain that Chris Matthews is spying on me because he brought it up one day. But he's the only other person I've heard bring it up. And then after he did, a couple people did in the media.
Maybe it's just great minds think alike.
My thought was that if the Republicans think we need a voter ID and they won't listen to reason that it's not needed, then why don't the Democrats come at this from a completely different angle and say, okay, you want a voter ID? Fine. Everybody gets a Social Security card. We're putting your picture on it, and we're phasing it in over the next 10 years, and that's how it's going to work on the national level. You know that they aren't going to let that fly. There's no way that Republicans are going to let something like that fly, because the point, and here's where this conversation gets lost, the point is not to verify that you are who you say you are. The point is to stop people from voting.
Exactly.
That's why these laws are not just saying you need to have this ID to vote. They're doing it state by state in different ways. They're phasing it in as close to elections as they can with very little heads up for voters so that they're hoping people won't be prepared. On top of that, these laws are also closing polling locations. They're shortening voting hours. They're moving polling locations. They're doing everything that they can under this guise of, oh, we just need fair elections. No, that is not it. That is not the case. So and they, whenever you're talking to someone about voter ID, I think it's important to point that out, that if you're truly believing that we need a voter ID so that we know there's no fraudulent voting, that's a conversation I think we can have. The fact of the matter is that these laws that are being proposed are not doing that.
Exactly right. So are the Republicans in the state legislature here in Wisconsin saying that Walker wasn't legitimately elected governor because he had so much voter fraud that it could have been anybody?
Maybe there you
Barrett,
go.
Maybe Barrett won.
There Who you knows? Go.
Or are they saying that he actually, instead of beating Barrett by 5 or 6 or 7 points, he actually would have beat him by 30 points if we had voter ID? What are they saying? That maybe he wasn't really elected governor?
Well, do you remember in the recall when he came out and he said that this was Walker speaking. He said something like, well, we need to make sure just to overcome the mass amounts of voter fraud, we've got to win by at least 7 points just to gain 1%. I remember him saying that. It was ridiculous. And then I think he did win by about 7%, which is somewhat ironic.
But the fact that he won by 7% may have had something to do with the fact that he had an 800% spending advantage in television advertising over his opponent.
And I wonder who owns those machines that we vote on. It's not the government.
Doesn't Diebold make those machines?
I think they do. And Mitt Romney's kid, I think, has something to do with that. I wonder if he's a Democrat or a Republican.
No, I think he's kind of a renegade. I don't even think he supported his father for president, did he? Oh, no, wait. He's the one who said he wanted to punch Obama in the face. Okay, so I guess he was for his father after all. Sorry, I was confused for a minute.
There's no conflict of interest there, though. No. Do not look behind the curtain, people.
That was my Chris Matthews imitation. without trying, just came out.
Okay, so where are we here? We talked about that.
You know, there's one, this is kind of off topic of things a little bit that we've been talking about, Eric, except that it's still about the judiciary. There was a case that came up this past week in the state of Missouri where a person who had been convicted of committing an armed robbery had been sentenced to 13 years in prison in the state of Missouri. It was happening at a time when the court allowed, and even now, courts in different states and different jurisdictions sometimes allow this. Some do, some don't. It's discretionary. It's never allowed in murder cases, but it's allowed in various cases. Sometimes they will sentence someone to a certain amount of time in prison, but give them a week or two or three to put their personal affairs in order before they go away. And if the court determines the person not to be a flight risk, and that can be determined in most cases, then they may give the person a week or two, as I said, to get their affairs in order. Well, that's what happened in the case of this particular person who had been convicted of a robbery and sentenced to 13 years. A little unusual maybe that he was given the time to put his affairs together, but it happened. They said, we will send you a notice telling you what day you must report to the jail, to the prison, okay? And so he waited. The notice never came. He went about his life. He didn't change his name. He didn't change his identity in any way. He got married, had kids, lived a legitimate life, had legitimate jobs, paid taxes, all those kinds of things. Nothing, caused no trouble, was never charged with another crime, nothing. 13 years hits, the prison system in Missouri looks at their records and says, oh, today's the day to release Joe Blow, whatever his name was, I don't recall. Oh, where's Joe Blow? He's not here. Oh, we forgot to tell him to show up. So what do? They don't send him a notice and say, well, you know, we made a mistake or anything like that. Sorry, you got to do this now. No, they come in with a SWAT team and kick his door down in front of his children, everything, who know nothing about this. And it's not his fault because he was told to wait for notice and he waited. Now, you could say, well, he should have, after 6 months or something, he should have called. Well, but there's no law that says that. And he was waiting for them to notify him. Maybe he was hoping that, you know, who knows? God was giving him a blessing somehow and whatever. But the point is, he wasn't breaking any laws. None. No one asserts that he was. So they kicked on his door and they now throw him in prison. And he's in for 13 years. So I'm thinking about that, and I'm thinking, what if I were his lawyer? What would I come up with, if anything, to try and help this man at this point? Because there seems to be some injustice in it. Yes, he did commit a crime. Yes, he was sentenced to it. But isn't it to be taken into consideration that the state failed in its promised a duty to send the man a notice of when he was to report for his incarceration? And they failed to do it. So I thought about it for a minute, and I thought, you know, what jumps to my mind is the provision in the United States Constitution against cruel and unusual punishment. And it seems to me that if you forget to send someone a notice for 13 years that he's supposed to show up for jail, and he goes about his life in the meantime in a totally lawful manner, doing nothing wrong and just being actually a good citizen, that there's something about, I mean, it's the state's mistake. Yeah, maybe he should have served his 13 years, but it's not his fault that he didn't. It's theirs. So if it's their mistake, oh, well. Here's the good news. You've seen the man has been a good citizen ever since. So he's causing no harm, right? So is it not, would it not be cruel and unusual punishment, which is barred by the United States Constitution, to kick down the man's door after 13 years when it was your own fault that you never sent him the letter, and then haul him off for 13 years of prison at that point? So I asked an attorney, I'll mention no names, but I would just say that I've met many attorneys in my life, including ones who have argued in front of the United States Supreme Court. And so the person who I consider the smartest attorney I've ever known, I presented that to him, and his response to me was that if I was a judge, I would consider that cruel and unusual punishment. So at least it gave me the affirmation that it was not a completely off-the-wall idea. I just hope this guy gets himself a lawyer who's thinking that way, because I can't. I'm not licensed in Missouri.
Wow, I'll say that's insane. I hadn't even heard about that. Couple last points before we go here is that you know, one thing I'd thought about with this whole voter ID being struck down is, will this be like gay marriage now, where as soon as gay marriage was, where the precedent was set in the courts, now the states are falling like dominoes by citing Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act? Is that what we're going to be looking at? One of the judges, is it Posner on the 7th District Court of Appeals, Circuit Court of Appeals, said, you know, he's the one who upheld the Indiana voter ID law, and he later came out and said that was a big mistake. There is a chance, if they appeal this, that it could go to, that yes, he could be on the panel that is going to decide this.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's how that works. We talked about it a little before, Eric. There's a number of judges, like a couple, like 15 or so, who are on the Seventh Circuit, but they usually have panels of three or five judges who will actually rule. They won't have all 15. So it's a little bit of luck of the draw who gets on there. It's a generally progressive bench, but not totally. But here's one thing that Van Hollen should be thinking about. Van Hollen needs to think about. I hope he doesn't think about it. But if he's diligent, he will. And that is this. There's a very big risk with him taking this. If he's looking at it from the national Republican point of view, which as far as I can see, everybody who's in this administration does, if they go to the Seventh Circuit and lose, they've just made law for the whole Seventh Circuit. Right now, what Edelman's done is only counts in Wisconsin, okay? But if they go to the Seventh Circuit, and Edelman is upheld, which is likely, in my opinion, then they have just, now that law, Edelman's ruling now applies to the several other states, which conceivably could have tried some other Republican voter suppression, but now Edelman's ruling will apply to those states. So that's a risk that Van Hollen takes in going to the Seventh Circuit.
That's a really interesting point. And I don't know enough about J.B. Van Hollen to say how I would expect him to go, but I guarantee you Scott Walker is arrogant enough to push that and take risk.
And the reason Scott Walker would take that chance is because he personally needs it for his political survival.
That's exactly right. The new polls are showing Mary Burke. A new conservative poll is showing her tied 47-47. That's a new one. That's not the old one. That came out this week. And then another one by PPP is showing her just down by 3 points. Marquette, I think, was still showing 6. Unfortunately, that takes us right up to the last minute of the show here. I just wanted to thank everyone out there for listening. Thank you to 350 Madison, Janesville Community Radio, for giving us this platform, of course. Thanks to the Economowoc Dems Thanks to the Rock County Progressives. Thank you to Democracy Rocks, the Democratic Party of Janes.
90 seconds.
Excuse me. The Democratic Party of Rock County. And please be sure to give us a like on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at symbol letter C discourse. Be sure to give us a 5-star rating over on iTunes and subscribe to our podcast. It'll come right to your account every week then. And tell your friends. That's the most important thing. Tell your friends. Try to get some of our publicity out there for us. Well, and if you have any questions, comments, concerns, please email us at civildiscourse2011.com.
And we are expecting to have Mary Burke as our guest next week. So unless anything changes, Mary Burke is expected to be on the program next week. Please spread the word on that, listeners. It should be a good interview.
Good call. I can't believe I didn't say that. Yes, we are expecting Mary Burke next week. And like I said, if you have questions, comments, concerns, anything you want us to ask Ms. Burke, civildiscourse2011@hotmail.com. That does it for this week. Thanks, Peter.
Thank you, Eric.